Welcome to the MuckReads podcast. I'm Marshall Allen, and I report on healthcare and patient safety for ProPublica. For this week's episode, we're joined by Mina Kimes of Fortune magazine to discuss her piece, Bad to the Bone, a Medical Horror Story. The report lays out how a multi-billion dollar medical device company engaged in what can only be called human experimentation on patients, with deadly results. The company illegally tested non-FDA-approved bone cement on people during spine procedures, causing blood clots that killed the patients within seconds.
So this is a story about a company called Synthes that was bought recently by Johnson & Johnson for about $20 billion. It was actually the biggest acquisition in J&J's history. It's a medical device company headquartered in Switzerland, although its global headquarters is actually in Pennsylvania, founded by a fairly reclusive Swiss billionaire named Hans-Jürg Wyss. So the story is about a product that they developed called Norion, which is a calcium phosphate bone cement that was initially approved to be put into cracks in the arm and skull. And it really tells about their efforts to convince doctors to use the product in the spine as a treatment for vertebral compression fractures, which the FDA explicitly forbade.
Tell us, what's a vertebral compression fracture?
Right. So it's commonly a side effect of osteoporosis. There's several hundred thousand a year. It's typically in the elderly. And basically what it is a fissure in the spine that is extremely painful.
And they basically promoted this. I mean, or you said in the story, it sort of had this kind of miraculous ability to turn into bone.
So it really
had a lot of promise, right?
Many people in the story, even some who knew what had happened with the company and the crime, described it as miraculous because the material, which was initially invented by a scientist in California, did have properties that enabled it to facilitate being replaced by actual human bone over time.
And so the idea then was that it would actually fill in these fractures in the bone and seal them or
exactly
heal them.
Restoring a patient's height and mobility.
Yeah, amazing. But where did this go wrong? What happened?
Right. So when Synthes bought Norion, which is the California-based company, you know, it already had approval to be used in certain things, and they purchased it with an eye towards promoting it for use in the spine, knowing how it was a really potentially lucrative market. There were so many patients who had this problem, and it was, for the reasons we just discussed, a really appealing solution. The problem was it was never approved as a treatment for this specific problem, which is vertebral compression fractures. So over the course of a couple years, the company made a series of ill-fated decisions that led to them promoting it for that use, even after receiving some very alarming scientific results and, as I describe in the story, some patient deaths.
There are a couple of big themes you hit on in the story, and you just kind of touched on them here, the science behind it and then also the promotion of it. So tell us, what kind of science was there that was put into the development of this treatment, that even with the use on the backs and things like
sure,
that?
Sure, yeah. Well, the original inventor was a man named Brent Constance, who was an entrepreneur in Cupertino. He was a geologist. He was inspired, I believe, by coral reef formations. The name Norion is based on a geological period. It's related to that. So he came up with this compound, this calcium phosphate-based compound that was actually stronger than the cement that was being used to treat these cracks, and got approval from the FDA for use in the arm, and that was Norion SRS, and then the scalp, which is Norion CRS.
Okay. And then when they started trying to apply it to the spine, what did they find scientifically then?
Well, this is really what's at the heart of what they did wrong, which is that they never did a clinical trial with people. So when a medical device maker wants to introduce a device for a new purpose, you know, there's a variety of ways in which they can get approval for it. But if it's a sort of an untested, high-risk device, often what they'll have to do is get something called a PMA, which requires clinical trials. As the company discussed internally before making the decision not to do it, these trials can be long and costly. Some employees estimated that it would take about 3 years and cost over $1 million. They would have to convince a large number of patients to do it.
They could also fail, right?
They could also fail. I mean, one of the things I think that probably deterred them from doing it was that the company had not had a lot of success doing this in the past. The other way that you can get approval is to establish similarity to an already approved device.
Is that it's like the
510K.
510K, yeah,
exactly.
Process, right.
So that's what they did. However, the approval that they got from the FDA through that process specifically said the first time, we're approving this for use in the spine, but you can't mix it, which is what needed to be done to use it for the treatment they wanted. And then the second time, they specifically said this cannot be used to treat vertebral compression fractures.
So they never had approval for what they were doing.
Exactly.
And then talk about the promotion of it, because that's also, so they didn't have approval, but they still began to promote it. In what ways did they promote it?
So what we're talking about is off-label marketing, which, you know, as anyone who follows the healthcare business knows, is extremely common crime that a lot of companies in recent years have paid huge settlements over, both drug and device makers. Doctors and surgeons are able to prescribe drugs and use devices in ways that they see fit. However, companies cannot promote them to doctors and surgeons for the unapproved uses, off-label uses. As you can imagine, this creates a bit of tension, especially when a company recognizes that doctors might be interested in using it in that fashion, or there's a potential revenue stream. So what we encountered in this story was that the company not only, you know, expressed before they actually started engaging with surgeons that they were interested in this unapproved use, but there was documented evidence that they promoted it for that use. I also interviewed many of the surgeons who were actually involved in the unauthorized clinical trials who indicated to me that, yes, they talked to Synthes sales representatives about this unauthorized use, and that in itself is off-label marketing.
And this actually killed some patients, right? How deadly was this practice?
Right. So between 2002 and 2004, which was really when the trials were going on, although the product continued to be used later, as I later discovered, and there were later deaths, there were three deaths. The first one was a 70-year-old woman whose x-rays were later used in materials to promote the product, which was a disturbing twist. And then later on, an 80-year-old man and an 80-year-old woman died, both on the operating table. In all cases, the patient's blood pressure dropped extremely quickly and they were unable to be resuscitated.
And what was the Bayan cement actually doing that caused the death?
Yeah, so in the first case, there was no autopsy. In the third case, there was. Actually, the second case, there was not either. But in the third case, there was. And they did find some fragments of cement in the lungs. And there was never any conclusive examination of what happened, but the second doctor and later the prosecutors theorized that the cement was forming an embolus and causing blockage in the bloodstream. That's also what happened in a completely separate animal trial conducted at the University of Washington, where scientists injected the cement into a pig that also died for the same reason.
And it basically created like massive blood clots.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. And they died really quickly, too. I was amazed, like within 30 seconds or something like
right.
that, they were gone. I mean, that's stunning how quickly it was. And yet the company then continued to promote this. And so tell us about what did you learn about the ways these devices are promoted from reporting this story?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons why so many companies continue to engage in off-label marketing is there's sort of this attitude of, well, we're just putting it out there and doctors will do what doctors want to do and we can't stop them, which is true. However, there are so many different ways in which companies cross the line, whether it's giving information to doctors, bringing these devices into certain surgeries, and in many cases observing the surgeries, giving them instructions on how to use it. So since these did all of these things and more, in one case, during a training session with surgeons, they explicitly showed them how to do this procedure. They were giving out materials that talked about the procedure. You know, in the aforementioned promotional materials that had the x-ray of the woman who died, they took out the warning that the FDA had told them to put in saying, don't use it for this procedure. So there were many ways in which they committed the crime.
So is this an example of regulation gone bad, or is this more an example of regulation actually took the steps to prohibit this use and then they just flaunted the regulation?
I think they definitely flaunted the regulation. The question, I think, of whether or not the regulations were strong or clear enough is a matter of discussion. You know, the FDA had issued a public warning about this procedure being off-label. There was some confusion amongst surgeons and the company about the label, and I know from my interviews with employees that they knew what they were doing was not right. That said, there's still a lot of gray area.
Now, you use the term, or maybe someone else in the story uses the term, human experimentation. I mean, anytime someone uses a term like that, it's going to get people's attention, right? Was this human experimentation?
I think it was, insofar as what they did was They held unauthorized clinical trials. They released and promoted a product for a use that was unapproved without informing patients that the product was unapproved. I mentioned this story. People participate in clinical trials all the time, but they do so knowingly. And I think that's really what is the core transgression here, is that some people had knowledge and some people didn't, and ultimately the people who did not were the patients.
So what does the story tell you about patient safety in general?
I think, going back to what we were just talking about, much of that has to do with knowledge. I mean, when you make a healthcare decision, you should be equipped with the best knowledge possible. And what this story was really about was the withholding of that knowledge at many crucial points, but especially to these patients who died, not knowing that this product had been used in animal trials where there were very alarming results, not knowing that it wasn't actually approved for the procedure that they were about to go into. So it's not necessarily the fault of the doctor that it was used in a certain way or the procedure was not done properly, but that rather that the risks weren't properly communicated.
It's amazing to me how many things, when you think about each interaction a patient has with the healthcare industry, there are so many different things going on behind the scenes that they never even know about that come to play and influence the decisions that are made really with them. And this is such an interesting illustration about it. What were the patients told?
They were each told different things by different surgeons, but all of their families maintain that they were not told about the unapproved nature of the product, about the animal trials, the risks associated with them. And there were three deaths that took place during the clinical trials, but there was another death that occurred in June of 2009 after the company had been indicted.
Wow.
So if the family had simply known the name of the product, and they say they weren't told the name, they could have Googled it and seen a criminal indictment filed 2 weeks earlier. I think there cannot be, however, too much of onus put on the patients to be proactively seeking out this information. I mean, I was thinking about, you know, while I was reporting this story, one of my parents had just had a major spine surgery, and I had no idea what devices were used. I had no idea what their status was. I had not sought out the information. And if I had wanted to, you know, I would have had, I'm a working journalist, and it would have been difficult. So even if there is transparency, I think, and sort of somewhat of honesty, you know, one wonders how we can better equip patients to know what's essentially being put into their bodies.
You mentioned the indictment, and I mean, there were actual criminal charges filed in this case. So talk about what the prosecutors found and why this reached criminal level instead of just something less than that.
So this was a really unusual legal case, and it's part of what interested me, I think, in writing about it, in that the U.S. Attorney's Office in Philadelphia, in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, indicted these executives under a sort of unusual slice of law called the Responsible Corporate Officer Doctrine that had never been used to send an executive to prison when they indicted them. Usually it resulted in just a fine. Or what they did was they, you know, first established that they were responsible for what had happened, and then basically showed that they had knowledge of all of these various decisions that led to, you know, what tragically ensued. And I think the fact that deaths were involved, that there were so many warning flags thrown up, which I sort of documented in the story, by scientists, by employees, employees who left the company, who expressed concerns, I think that's what really spurred them to sort of take it to this level.
And so did these executives actually spend time in prison for this?
They did, yes. There were four executives who were convicted, and one spent 5 months, two spent nine, and one spent eight. And it's so funny, when I talk about the story, I think people are, that's it? But that's actually really unusual, and that's a lot. And that tells you something, I think, about sort of the state of, you know, corporate crime in this country, how difficult it is to indict executives for anything.
And I wrote a story one time about a patient, an error that occurred during a surgery and caused a surgical fire, and the patient caught fire, actually, and ended up dying. And the hospital, I think, was fined $400 by regulators in that case. And it's very common to have these really small fines and things like that. Yeah, it's white-collar crime. It's It's the influence of powerful people on the laws that get made so that not a lot can be done. But it's really, really disturbing. It's out of balance.
It's really disturbing. And I think it'll be interesting to see the effect that this case has on indictments going forward in terms of prosecuting individuals. I think the DOJ would hope that it might lead to more prosecutions of individuals under this doctrine. Defense attorneys, including one of the attorneys who represented one of these executives, argued that it'll just convince executives not to plea to this crime. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, they'll just fight harder. What about, what does it tell you about the corporate culture at this company? Synthes, is that what it's called?
Or Synthes, yeah.
Synthes, yeah. What was that? What did you learn about that?
Right, so, you know, after I sort of got all the facts of the case from the documents and the information that was already out there, a lot of what I was interested in finding out was, what was the culture like? Why, not necessarily did these people make these, because I already knew that they made these decisions, but why they did. And what I learned from my interviews with people who worked there was that it was a very strict culture. They called it getting synthesized to work there, which was that, you know, you kind of follow the rules, you do what you're told. The CEO of the company was a very dominant, many said intimidating, you know, character. I think all of these things kind of played a role in some of the decisions that were made.
And was that top person ever convicted in any way or charged?
No, he was mentioned but not named in the indictment as having made the initial decision not to do clinical trials.
I'm curious, just as a journalist, did you have any big obstacles that you had to overcome when you were reporting this story? Or
I think when you're reporting on a crime, even if it's a case that's been closed, people are always reluctant to talk about it. Even people who weren't clearly not guilty or not even necessarily involved. So I think convincing people of the importance of setting the record straight and being accurate about a fairly controversial story was sort of one of the bigger challenges.
How did you go about convincing them?
I always find if you can convey to interview subjects, employees, former employees of companies, that you're really serious about learning every possible thing about the subject, and then you already know quite a bit about it, they're often interested in making sure the final product is comprehensive and accurate.
Another thing I'm curious about is the promotion and the marketing of these kind of devices. How much of an influence did it have over the practices of physicians? And then can you generalize that at all? I mean, how much influence does marketing have over what physicians do?
I think there's a great deal of influence, but there has to be a sort of a confluence of factors, which is, you know, the appetite for the product was already out there. This was a procedure that was growing in popularity at the time. There was no clear treatment. I mean, there were vertebroplasties were being conducted using a different kind of cement that had a lot of disadvantages. So there was certainly an audience for it, and surgeons knew that. And when they were presented with this miraculous seeming product and not told about some of the issues, you know, the scientific trials, I imagine it was quite convincing. You know, many of them were flown out to training sessions, you know, where they had dinners and golf outings and whatnot. And at those training sessions, they were told all the good things about it and all the potential for it. And many walked away thinking it was a really wonderful opportunity.
Did they withhold that information from these doctors as well about their, I'm assuming they did, the troubles with the clinical trial?
Most of the, the surgeons that I spoke to say they didn't know about the issues with the animals dying. You know, the label, however, they could read it at. So,
right. I mean, they would have known that it wasn't approved for this particular use, right?
Exactly. But, you know, as we were talking about earlier, surgeons can use products however they see fit.
Right. They can do it off-label. What do you think, if you had to say in general, what do you think the public should know about the device industry?
One of the most surprising things to me, I think, in reporting this story was just a little detail, which was that in all of these surgeries, there was a sales representative in the room watching this. I didn't know that before. And I think that's very emblematic of the relationship between doctors and companies, which is very intermeshed and very codependent in some ways. So I think that's something that needs to continue to be examined. You know, when doctors do these surgeries, what are the devices they're using? Why are they using those devices? And do patients have all of the information about not just the procedure, but the device that's being used in the procedure? going forward.
Well, Mina, this was a fantastic story. I really appreciate you coming in to talk to us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.